The gang's all here.
Thanks for coming back, James. We missed you.
Of course. Although I do have to address one thing from last week that I think kind of got swept under the rug.
We don't talk about this before recording.
Nick said,
It's always
Mueller.
Me. No, I didn't. I said,
yes, you
I
did. Said, you
I
said Mueller.
No, I said something. I said but it wasn't Mueller.
You said Mueller. And you tried to just ignore it, but I
don't think the fans like this.
Oh yeah,
I think they do.
I think this is a great comeuppance for you.
We'll put a poll up, see if they like when we rag on Nick.
Sure, put the poll up.
We will.
I think I'm a fan favorite.
I like how you can
Let's
get that out
about
without
what
laughing. Y'all, yes. We're super excited to have our guests on. We have two amazing field organizers from the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, also known as APANO. We have Jay Singh and Robin Yee. So stick around to hear about all their incredible hard work and like vast array of activism.
Yeah, they are very cool.
Busy people.
Yes, they are.
Also, just a quick note. So we talk about our candidates to get excited about. Last week, we talked about Austin Davis for state representative of the 35th Legislative District in Pennsylvania, and he won. So
whoop, 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 whoop.
He won.
I think
Dem
he won
because
we talked about him.
I think that's true, that we were yes. Bell Bump.
I think
WBB.
I think our endorsement truly was what tipped the needle.
Yeah.
And also I feel like we kind of ended the shutdown, right? Because, you know.
I don't know. Well, we'll get into that.
Let's
I don't
actually,
know if we should take credit for that one.
That is a great transition to just slide right into.
So
because it's our first topic.
Because it seems like as soon as we finished, well, I wasn't here, but the podcast went out and then all of a sudden.
I had an eerie feeling that would happen.
The shutdown
was
over.
I had an eerie feeling. That's why I'm the fan favorite. My premonitions. I'm just kidding. I'm going to get in trouble after this.
Yeah.
Okay. Government shutdown ends after 3 days of recriminations. From a New York Times article by Cheryl Gay-Stahlberg and Thomas Kaplan. Congress brought an end to a three-day government shutdown on Monday as Senate Democrats buckled under pressure to adopt a short-term spending bill to fund government operations without first addressing the fate of young undocumented immigrants. The House quickly approved the measure, which will fund the government through February 8th and extend funding for the popular Children's Health Insurance Program for 6 years, and President Trump signed it on Monday night. But a key part of the deal, a pledge by Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, and the majority leader to allow an immigration vote in the coming weeks, sets the stage for a battle over the so-called Dreamers, young undocumented immigrants who were brought to the United States illegally as children. The vote in the Senate was lopsided. 81 senators voted in the shutdown, while 18, two Republicans and the rest of the Democrats, and an independent who caucuses with the Dems, sided against the measure. In the House vote, the vote was 266 to 150, with about three-quarters of Democrats opposed. The measure also shored up the Children's Health Insurance Program, known as CHIP, which insures nearly 9 million children. States had warned that they were on the verge of having to end the coverage after Congress allowed funding for the program, which had been created and sustained for 2 decades with bipartisan support to expire in September.
Did you take a breath there, Nick?
I don't know. I just always pretend that I'm Jake Tapper when I read the New York Times articles.
Okay.
Oh, I need some more
that
like,
explains
eye rolls
a lot.
And like frustration.
I said that I just pretend it like helps me get through it.
No, I'm saying I'm just like to accentuate the character. I just, you know, because Jake doesn't deal with anyone's BS.
Yeah,
anymore.
He's bae. Yes. Tapper is bae.
Anyways, I just was concerned about your respiratory capacity, but we can get back into
no,
the topic.
No, I'm a classically trained theater actor, so my breath support.
Everyone, I apologize.
I have worked with the Royal Shakespeare Company. That is true.
So have I.
Well, I don't hear your breath support. So you'll read something long next. okay, so I think this is interesting. A lot of people were upset. I'm just curious what you guys think about this. So CHIP was on the table beforehand, and it was being used by the Republicans as a bargaining piece, even though it never should have been.
Yep.
A lot of people were mad at Chuck Schumer and the Democrats for agreeing to this deal because the whole thing was about DACA. The whole thing was about undocumented people getting rights in this country. DACA was the hill to Democrats to die on. We talked last week about that. I am curious what you guys think about this because I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong in this. And if you listeners think that I'm wrong, please email because we love to talk to people about this. I don't think you should trust Mitch McConnell as far as you can throw him and
not
less than that, frankly. But Chuck Schumer, you know, the government is set to expire on February 8th. It was only extended for 3 weeks
right.
And they took CHIP off the table. So no longer can Republicans be branding it as it's the children's health insurance program or it's undocumented people. Like, you got to pick one. What Democrats did was they said, Mitch McConnell, guarantee a conversation on this. Take CHIP off the table. And the government's only funded for 3 more weeks. So the Democrats can shut down the government again. The deadline for DACA to expire is in March, which I agree is still way too close. And I don't know if I agree with them playing this high stakes game with people's lives. That being said, they did take CHIP off the table, which was set to expire, I believe, like tomorrow or something. Yeah. Very soon.
Very soon.
So I'm, you know, there's part of me that's like, well, you guys definitely buckled under DACA, but I'm also curious to see what happens in the next 3 weeks. They didn't extend the government for 2 years or a year. They extended the government for 3 weeks. I don't think Chuck Schumer's an idiot. He has made DACA his primary thing. I mean, his profile picture on Twitter, everything he talks about is DACA, DACA, DACA. Mm-hmm. I don't think he buckles under that without a plan, unless he's an idiot. I mean, he could be.
He could be, but, like, you know, it's the negotiation tactics, and it's as Senator Kamala Harris says, you know, that's 700,000 young people whose lives are in balance. So it's not it's not an immediate fix, which we were all hoping for. We were hoping that this shutdown was going to give us the answers that many people were seeking, and now we're kind of just like back in limbo again. But you can't. Right. I mean, and I get it. Yeah, we took CHIP off the table. That's great, but like, it's still up in the air. And who's to say that McConnell's going to stay on his word,
which,
and we're
going to
have the
he
conversation that we want. So that's why everyone's upset, and I understand that completely. So I'm not entirely sold on the fact that we're now back and like we're only funded for like 3 more weeks and then we're about to be in the exact same situation again. I want there to be a fix. I want these people to be able to live in the country that they only know. You know, but I just don't know if the Democrats necessarily, I don't know. I can't read Chuck Schumer's mind. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, do I agree that the Dems buckled? 100%. I think that it should have been, they should have absolutely been way more involved and shut down the government. They had the polling support. They had everybody's support. Shut down the government. If you're going to make it about DACA, then shut it down about DACA. Mm-hmm. I will say that they did get CHIP, and not a lot of people are talking about that. Mm-hmm. We'll see how the next 3 weeks go.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was going to say. It's like, I don't know what, like, if we're not, like, I guess we're not really labeling our thoughts here as right or wrong as the next step or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no one's talking about that they did get CHIP, but I don't know.
I don't know. It's tough. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's
really tough.
If you want to help out with DACA and the fight for undocumented immigrants in this country, you can check out United We Dream. That's a really important organization that's helping out. You can go to unitedwedream.org. There's a very pretty orange donate button. So take action. If the Democrats don't do anything on DACA, that's it. You know, we need to clean house. I'm curious how the next 3 weeks go, but...
Yeah.
All right.
Stephen Wynn, the finance chairman for the Republican National Committee, resigned this week amid controversy over sexual misconduct allegations.
I wish there was a website similar to
like a burn book.
Yes, that's what I was like trying to. Yes, that is the metaphor. Mm-hmm. Just because now it's like all these, so many in so many fields, jobs are opening.
I mean, we're not even talking about Michigan State and the whole gymnastics.
Oh,
thing.
Yeah,
unbelievable. You know, but so many jobs are opening up for like good quality people and I don't know, women and minorities to step into because all of these men are having to quote unquote resign for sexual misconduct allegations.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was, I hope someone is making an all encompassing list to track this.
We should just do, I mean, I'm not going to volunteer for it because the list will
go on
forever.
Why not, James?
James, you don't have time.
You know, I just, I
do not have time.
I don't know. Man. I don't know why. I don't know. Yeah, that's just a thought I had.
No,
I don't know why it necessarily. Because I'm just curious, like, to watch who steps into those roles mainly. Less to be like, yay, now we have a list of people we can hate. And more to be like, this many of jobs open up. These are just the people we know of. And just to see how it kind of affects all the different industries.
Sure.
Anyways.
But what
do you guys think that the all the money that Steve Wynn gave to Republicans should be returned? Like they made the big stink about
Harvey Weinstein. Yeah, they said the exact same thing. So I don't, if you're going to call it out like that, I haven't seen any. Have any Republicans come out and said that about Wynn?
I haven't heard anything.
So I just find it, you know, if you're going to mudsling, you know, be ready to have some thrown back at you.
I just typed into Google Wynn money and was going to keep like asking a question and the automatic word that popped up was laundering. So
add
my
that
Google
to the list.
So my my Google search was win money laundering, which is not what I meant to search. But
he probably
funny.
Did some of that stuff too. So RNC chairman Rhoda McDaniel said she accepted Wynn's departure on Saturday. Quote, said, "Today I accepted Steve Wynn's resignation as Republican National Chairman National Committee Finance Chair. He's facing allegations of sexual misconduct following a story in the Wall Street Journal that published on Friday. He denies the allegations, calling them preposterous."
Which is also just not, even if you are innocent, that is not the way to handle the situation.
Sure. So, but he stepped down. I think,
he did
step
down.
I do think that if you're going to make a big deal, I mean, you know, Debbie Stabenow turned all the Harvey Weinstein, Debbie Stabenow, Senator of Michigan, turned her, I think, donations from Harvey Weinstein. She donated them to
a domestic something.
Yeah, domestic violence.
Violence organization.
Among that. I think that if Republicans want to walk the walk as much as they talk the talk, maybe
TikTok,
they should.
Here we go.
They, you know, donate it to programs. Don't pocket that money.
Yeah.
Speaking of shady things that Republicans are definitely involved in, rushing into things.
Hey.
Do you like that title, everybody?
I made that
James
one.
James made that one.
James, we're so proud of you.
Oh, you know, well, I aim to please.
He's the poster child of
Nick
this podcast.
Nick tried to play footsie with me under the table.
I did not. I'm
Stop it.
Boys.
He started it.
How about you?
Oh, okay. So let's talk about this article that's in front of us here. All right. So Sessions, our favorite Keebler elf, was interviewed by special counsel Robert Mueller as part of a Russia inquiry.
The last name is what?
Mueller.
Okay.
Nick.
Oh, God.
All right. So this is an NPR article by Ryan Lucas and Carrie Johnson. So Attorney General Jeff Sessions was interviewed last week by special counsel Robert Mueller as part of the investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 election. So Sessions is the first member of President Trump's cabinet known to have been questioned by the special counsel's office in its investigation into possible coordination between Trump campaign and Moscow. In the attorney general's meeting, which was first reported by the New York Times, Sessions answered questions about the Trump campaign's contacts with Russians and their proxies during the 2016 presidential campaign. The Times also reported that Mueller's office spoke with former FBI Director James Comey last year. So Sessions is understood to have discussed possible obstruction of justice in the firing of Comey, a dismissal that Sessions supported. So we're getting a little bit closer.
War room.
War room. It's
Put
happening.
It in your war room. I know everybody's got a Russian war room.
But then, once we find out that Sessions has been spoken to, Trump
says he would love to speak under oath
in the Mueller probe. That's a bold thing to just say out
this
loud for everyone to hear.
Mm-hmm. An article by Jennifer Epstein and Justin Sink. Donald Trump said that he would, quote, love to talk under oath to special counsel Robert Mueller, who's investigating whether anyone close to the president colluded with Russia during the 2016 campaign. Quote is, I would do it under oath, period. Absolutely. He told reporters in a surprise appearance briefing on Wednesday, suggesting that it might happen in the next 2 or 3 weeks. And quite frankly, as Emily, I would love to see that.
But here's the funny thing.
Under oath.
And
absolutely.
So anytime
period.
He does something like this, though, you always, I feel like there should be a cartoon about this. His lawyers have to chase behind him and be like, okay, wait, come back.
Yeah, totally.
Let's talk first.
Like a child.
They're like, shh. It's
like, please come back. Maybe we'll talk to him. So now, apparently, they've been talking with Mueller and his aides about how this interview could go down. So so that's the next step here. They met last month with the special prosecutor's team and have been speaking by the phone as part of a continuing exchange over logistics that could take several weeks. But Trump also interestingly said he didn't remember asking the FBI deputy director Andrew McCabe who he had voted for in the 2016 election.
He's got world-class memory.
Right. He remembers all the
best
things.
I know how he loves the elephants.
He doesn't remember asking that question, as it was Washington Post reported this past Tuesday, that he asked McCabe about his vote during an Oval Office meeting shortly after Comey was fired, citing several anonymous current and former U.S. officials who said that happened. You know, this guy with the memory of either an elephant or a peanut, we're not entirely sure, but he...
That was nice.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You know. I try. Elephants
like peanuts?
Elephants like the peanuts.
There you go.
So that's why. It's just very interesting that, you know, Trump is, he's so bold and saying like, oh yeah, I can totally do it. But like, you know, you did something wrong and you're going to incriminate yourself, sir.
Been down this road with you.
But then the next big story happened, which is that Trump ordered Mueller to be fired, but backed off when the White House counsel threatened to quit.
Yeah, this was a wild story.
This was... wild.
Yeah, so it's in New York Times by Michael Schmidt and Maggie Haberman. Excuse me.
Podcast favorites.
We talk
about Maggie a lot.
I just think
the
New York Times recently has been a little too cozy with Trump. I've been a WAPO boy since day one, and I'll be a WAPO boy till I die.
Yeah, yeah. No, but
that's true. But
WAPO.
But Maggie,
we're not saying WAPO?
WAPO?
You say Washington.
So
all right, I say
so
WAPO.
President Trump ordered the firing of firing last June of Robert S. Mueller the second.
Third.
Wow.
Get
I looked
wrecked.
At that
Get
and saw
wrecked,
three
Emily.
In
Get
my head.
Absolutely wrecked after you called me out. Ha ha ha.
Oh, the special counsel overseeing the Russian investigation, according to four people told of the matter. I really want to know who those four people are.
I have a there's theories about yes. this. Oh, I'm yeah. going to tinfoil hat it for a second.
Yeah, yeah. Cool.
Well, Bill Kristol, who is a conservative columnist, surmised on Twitter that this was potentially Don McGahn, White House counsel, or people that are part of his counsel, because this talks about when he tried to fire Mueller in June or July. And so the idea is that he's potentially thinking about doing it again. And so they leaked to the press to be like, don't do this. Don't do this. Look how people will react. The thought of doing it, people are talking about impeaching you. Don't do this. Because I don't think that Trump necessarily listens all the time. So I think that they might have leaked it as a way of showing him. I mean, he doesn't listen at all. But mm-hmm. that's what Bill Kristol thought on Twitter. Whether
it's an interesting thought.
It's an interesting thought?
Mm-hmm.
Drive, it has a tinfoil hat on it, but it is a very interesting thought.
I mean, I think that Trump responds to the press, so you drive him with the press.
Yeah.
So anyway...
Anyways, okay, so, but he ultimately backed down after the White House counsel threatened to resign rather than carrying out the directive. So amid the first wave of news media reports that Mr. Mueller was examining a possible obstruction case, the president began to argue that Mr. Mueller had three conflicts of interest that disqualified him from overseeing the investigation. Two of the people said, oh, I want to know who they are.
Yeah, and these are interesting. So first he claims that a dispute years ago over fees at Trump National Golf Club in Sterling, Virginia, had prompted Mueller, the FBI director at the time, to resign his membership. First of all, a petty grievance like that is not a reason to discount someone from an investigation. So let's take that off the table. Then the president also said that Mr. Mueller could not be impartial because he had most recently worked with the law firm that previously represented the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Finally, the president said Mr. Mueller had been interviewed to return as the FBI director the day before he was appointed special counsel in May. I just don't see how I'm not sure who told him that these were viable reasons to cast any doubt on Mueller. But like, dude, you're like, it's just clear that, you know, you have someone that's going to investigate you and do it well. And you're just scared.
Yeah,
that's all that is. It's just fear. Yeah.
And yes, yes. And no, let's just say guilty or innocent. It is scary to be investigated, but don't act guilty if you're not guilty.
Right. And the thing was with Donald F. McGahn, who was the White House counsel at the time. So he refused. So after he received the order to fire Mueller, he refused to ask the Justice Department to dismiss him. And he said that he would rather quit. And they spoke on these people that the four people, they spoke on the condition of anonymity because they did not want to be identified discussing a continuing investigation.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure Trump is losing his mind about who these four people are. And there's like the White House is in shambles. But I'd say thank you to those four people.
Yeah,
I appreciate that.
Deadline looms for Trump and Russia sanctions. This is a political article by Alana Shore. President Donald Trump's willingness to crack down on Russia will be seriously tested come Monday. Trump faces a major deadline to use the Russia sanctions, the power Congress overwhelmingly voted to give him, and it's anybody's guess as to whether he'll comply on time after missing the last deadline. And they have reason to worry about whether the popular sanctions package Trump reluctantly signed in August will be implemented just as hesitantly. The Russia provisions of the bill were designed as a response to Moscow's meddling in the 2016 election, which the president himself has downplayed. So that's another thing on the horizon. Keep an eye out for that. This podcast will be playing on Monday, so you can check out if he enacted these sanctions. Here's a hint. He won't, because nothing matters. So let's just move on to bad news. So we didn't talk about this at the top. More bad news.
Sorry, y'all.
We didn't talk about this at the top. There was a school shooting, which got pretty much brushed under the rug.
Yes, which is unbelievable.
Yeah. So in a Kentucky school shooting, two students were killed and 18 were injured. It's from a CNN article by Holly Yan and Claire Stapleton and Paul P. Murphy. 16 people were wounded, two of them fatally, after a shooter opened fire Tuesday morning at Marshall County High School, authorities said. Four others sustained various injuries. A 15-year-old male student was arrested at the scene, Governor Matt Bevin said. On Wednesday, he was charged with 2 counts of murder and 12 counts of first-degree assault, Marshall County Assistant Attorney Jason Darnold told reporters. After the boy has a probable cause hearing and a detention hearing in the next 2 days. Prosecutors will start the process of charging him as an adult.
This just goes back to, I mean, we interviewed Jennifer Hoppe, the deputy director of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. And one of her quotes that she said that has stuck with me since that interview is, every day is the day to talk about gun control.
I mean,
in this
country. Schools.
Every day.
If you want to go to, you can go to momsdemandaction.org. That's MOMSDEMANDACTION.org. And there is a pretty donate button on the right. All of them seem to be on the right on all these websites. So go to Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. You can donate. You can check out Every Town. That's a branch of Moms Demand Action. You can get involved. This is a political issue, whether you want to admit it or not. You can follow the Second Amendment and not have views that everybody needs to have a gun or teachers need to have guns.
Yep.
This is out of control.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So we'll keep you in the loop on that moving forward.
Great movie, In the Loop.
Haven't seen it.
Armando Iannucci. It's about America's entrance into the Iraq War, but it's funny. It's got Zach Woods in it. Armando Iannucci then created Veep.
And Veep is truly mm-hmm.
Peter Capaldi
my
is
favorite.
In it.
I love Peter Capaldi.
See, look
the
at
doctor.
That. And the guy from, oh my God, what's his name? From
I don't
the
know.
Mafia show on HBO. The
Sopranos.
Who played Tony Soprano? I'm embarrassed that I'm missing this.
Oh, James.
Gandolfini.
Gandolfini.
Yeah, yep. James Gandolfini's in mm-hmm. it too. Really good. Zach Woods, James Gandolfini. Armando Iannucci in the loop. Check it out. It's on DVD. So Trump to impose a 30% tariff on solar cell imports. President Trump has approved tariffs on imported solar cells and certain washing machines. This is from a CNBC article by Christine Wang. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Leitzinger announced Monday the protective tariffs on both kinds of imports would initially kick in at a higher rate in the first year than decrease in subsequent years. For the first year, a 30% tariff would be applied to imported solar modules and cells. Mike Bloomberg, the billionaire former mayor of New York City, said in a post on Twitter that taxing solar panels up to 30% will destroy U.S. jobs, raise Americans' electric bills, and hurt our environment, a Trump specialty. Congress should stand up for American workers and consumers and overturn the administration's harmful decision.
Yep.
Isn't this part of Trump's whole like America first thing yeah. where it's like basically, oh yeah, we're going to make it, we're going to build it, we're going to do everything here, America first. And it's like, you don't actually believe that. You just want to create this image that we have the technology to make these things well, and it's like we kind of need help.
I agree. And well, and South Korea and China decried the Trump administration's new tariffs. Seoul said it would file a complaint about the changes, and Beijing said the U.S. was deteriorating the global trade environment. I mean, yeah, it's America first stuff. There was another article that said that Trump is he brought back coal jobs, but coal jobs, the amount of people dying has doubled this year.
And we on our third episode with Madison Stan,
Madeline.
Mm-hmm. There's no such thing as clean coal.
No, yeah,
it's not a thing.
No, it's very unfortunate that mm-hmm. it's like one thing. Just have one thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If you have one thing, maybe we can work somewhere. But everything is anti-environment, anti-anything. Yeah. This is our last piece of bad news. Do anyone would like?
Sorry.
Would you like to
say it? I'll give it. I'll give the bad news. Trump's Voter Fraud Commission requested records for all Texans with Hispanic surnames. Okay. Lots to unpack there.
This is why Democrats need to make DACA a big deal and then move on to comprehensive immigration reform. Because this is mm-hmm. targeting.
Truly insane. Yeah, it's targeting, and also it just like rides that assumption that like every person who is Hispanic or partially Hispanic has a Hispanic last name. It's like we're far past, you know, like I know Hispanics
families,
with the last name of
families.
Smith. Yeah. You know, like this is acting on a stereotype that is constantly changing and has not necessarily been proven true. It's just insane. Anyways, mm-hmm. so the article we're quoting from is by Chris Baines, who's in The Independent. Donald Trump's controversial voter fraud commission asked for files on every Texan with Hispanic surname. Newly released documents show the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity made the request last year while applying to obtain nearly 50 million voter records from the state with the second largest Hispanic population in the U.S. on the data request form. Policy advisor Ron Williams ticked a box asking for a Hispanic surname flag notation to be included in the files. Officials said the data was never supplied because of a lawsuit filed by voting rights campaigners blocked the state from sending the information to the commission. Shout out to activism. Documents obtained by Missouri Democrat Senator Claire McCaskill show the commission having had paid for voter records in some states that refused to provide them for free. Among the files was an invoice for $3,437.30 to be paid to obtain data on the 49.6 million registered voters in Texas, including details of those with Hispanic surnames.
Let's get some good news.
Let's move to good news.
So,
Nick,
the Pennsylvania Supreme Court struck down the state's congressional map, saying it illegally benefits the GOP. This is from a Huffington Post article by Sam Levine. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court on Monday ruled that the state's congressional map went so far to benefit Republicans that it clearly, plainly, and palpably violated the state constitution. The court, where Democrats have a 5-2 majority, blocked the use of the map in the 2018 midterm elections, ordered state lawmakers to begin to draw a new map. The suit against the congressional map, which only challenged it under Pennsylvania's state constitution, was one of the most watched voting rights cases in the country. The ruling could encourage groups to bring similar challenges against congressional gerrymandering cases in other states and bypass a ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court, which is currently considering two cases dealing with partisan gerrymandering. The suit, which was brought by the League of Women Voters on behalf of 18 voters in each of the state's congressional districts, said that the GOP lawmakers had retaliated against Democratic voters for supporting Democratic candidates, violating the equal protection and free expression guarantees in the state constitution. So this is a very big deal. This is a highly gerrymandered area in Pennsylvania, one of the worst in the country, that is being shut down. So we hope that other states... you know, Texas is a pretty good example, I think, of heavy gerrymandering. I might be wrong on that, but there are a number of states around the United States that have heavy gerrymandering, and they seem to always benefit the GOP. There are groups around the country that are doing things to stop this, which is fantastic. So keep getting involved with that. Find these groups. The League of Women Voters is one of them. It's very important. So let's talk about Canada, get excited about, and then we'll get out of here.
Yes.
The Grammys are on right now.
Also, we have a bomb-ass interview.
Yeah, I know, but we already did the interview.
Yeah, you're right.
We have a bomb-ass interview that we already did.
James?
Okay, so our candidate to get excited about, his name is Brian Santamaria. He's a congressional candidate for Minnesota's 3rd District.
Minnesota.
All right, so interesting thing about him, he's a former comedy writer. Didn't know what he says he wrote.
I'll be the
sketch.
Judge of that.
And, all right. Well, Nick is already on his high horse.
Nick is just jealous.
High horse so is
if
so
you
high.
If you happen
20
to stop,
hands.
If you happen to stop at his website, which is BrianSantamariaForCongress.com, you can learn a lot about this guy and the way he's describing a lot of his policy. It's actually very conversational. He seems like a really down-to-earth person, but he's very involved. In fact, he had this this one quote. I care about the uninsured because I was uninsured. I take sides with the sick because I was sick. I will protect the dying because I was dying. I spent many months thinking they were my last ones on this planet. And I believe deeply in the soul my God gave me in not-for-profit medicine because it saved my life. So he cares about healthcare for all, paid maternity leave, robots and how important they are in the job force, but also how important it is for coding and education in coding because computers are the way of the future.
Yes. Yes.
So we need to work on that.
Coding for women.
Yes. And so there's public works and community preservation, like the parks that his daughter plays in, which he describes on his website as well. So if you have a chance, go ahead and check out his website. Again, that's BrianSantamariaForCongress.com. If you're in Minnesota, give this guy a look because he sounds like a really great progressive Democrat that wants to make some positive changes.
Also, Minnesota is the land of feisty Democrats. Mark Dayton, Paul Wellstone, Amy Klobuchar, Tina Smith replaced Al Franken. So Minnesota Democrats, they're pretty great.
Shout out to Minnesota. I've heard
Minnesota.
It's great over there, and I've never been. But
Minnesota,
if someone wants to invite me there, that's where the Mall of America is, right?
Mm-hmm, I've been in it.
Someone invite me to the Mall of America.
Gigantic.
And I will
You're invited.
Go.
All right.
Yes.
I think we should get into our interview.
All right. Let's do it.
All right. So stick around for Jay Singh and Robin E., field organizers of the at the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, Apano. Boom.
See you guys in a second.
Bye.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back. We're so excited to have not one, but two guests on this week. From the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon. We have on two of their field organizers, Jay Singh and Robin Yee, and we're super excited. So, hey, y'all, welcome to We Rebel.
Hello, hello. Hello, hello. Thank you for having us on.
Of course. We're super excited to jump in. And we tend to start all of our interviews with a question that is similar or the same, you might say. And I'd love to hear from each of you individually about, you know, what was that moment in your life where you knew you were going to be an activist? Like, what was your spark to get you going on this incredible journey?
Yeah, so I guess in high school, I didn't think of the word activist, but I wanted to be a journalist in high school. You know, I wanted to cover like politics and like movements, and I guess what I now understand to be activism. But you know, I thought that writing and telling stories was activism in that it was asking questions of people and letting people know that you were paying attention to what they were doing. So my spark was in high school, I wrote for like my senior thesis, I wrote about a big like Portland public school bond measure that was like $500 million that would like change education in Portland. And I, yeah, just did a big research project on that and haven't really stopped since.
Yeah. Cool. So for me, this is Jay. I think the spark that initially inspired me to become engaged in my local community was really learning about how my built environment was impacting the health of my community, family and I, specifically studying environmental and social and health impacts of like autocentric suburban sprawl. And I think there are different avenues to address this issue. And I just happened to take an organizing approach. I went through an organizer and training internship at another local nonprofit called Opal Environmental Justice, and where I really learned the in and out in science and art of community organizing for 10 weeks here. And so I think that's really what politicized me in the summer of 2016.
Amazing. I think one of our consistent themes is a lot of our organizers, the spark comes from some sort of educational setting, you know, school or a class or that. So it's fun to hear that you're in line with our other guests. And so I'm curious, what was your path? How did you get to this specific organization?
Yeah, this is Robin. Sorry, I didn't introduce myself the first time.
No worries.
Yeah, again, like you said, in school. So I was I went to school at the University of Chicago. So just a rich, you know, organizing history there on the South Side. I guess I really took the plunge into organizing or identified as an organizer after working as a volunteer with the Bernie Sanders campaign. He's a, you know, an alma mater of University of Chicago, so it was really exciting. And then, you know, after college, I worked on a big statewide ballot measure here in Oregon. And then I actually took a stint doing some union organizing in the healthcare industry. And then, now I'm at APANO, and we, you know, specifically organize with Asian and Pacific Islander communities. And, you know, I identify as Chinese American, and I'm from the state. So it's been really special being able to work, you know, directly with people that I, you know, see myself with.
Yeah, for me, I grew up in the South, but I moved to Oregon, Portland, Oregon, about 4 years ago. And, you know, I identify as South Asian, Sikh Punjabi. And so I really found out about APANO when I was going through my master's program at Portland State University. There was an internship opportunity that arose that I was interested in, and as a climate resilience intern. And I really just took that opportunity to learn about, you know, what APANO was doing and you know, use my skills to sort of try to help with their programs.
So for Robin, question for you. So you were working on, so we have the Yes on Measure 97 campaign that went through. So here was something that was, you know, on a huge state level, right? And it was something that obviously was speaking to you. And then you transitioned into something a little more specific with APANO. So how do you balance that? We talk about the intersectionality of activism and ways to get out. And so how did you find that, you know, there was obviously something on a larger scale you wanted to fix, but at the same time, you felt like there was a community of people whose voices needed to be heard and you wanted to fight for them. So how did you balance the two?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, politics, or a lot of the times in organizing, timing is everything. So, you know, here was this, you know, ended up being the largest statewide campaign ever in Oregon, right? Measure 97. So,
wow.
And yeah, and you know, Apano and the organization that I worked for afterwards, SEIU, the labor union, they were both, you know, major partners on that effort. So it was seeing that, you know, these organizations that on the surface, you know, you don't think of as the traditional like campaign wagers or, you know, campaigners, but they were there at the table, at least here in Oregon, you know, in community fighting for the same things that we all believed in. So that kind of showed me for the first time how like these things aren't mutually exclusive, and that if you wanted to, you know, we didn't end up winning Measure 97, but you could see that the work that we've done wasn't for naught, because these organizations like Apano persist, you know, continue today and build off of all of the organizing work that went into that statewide campaign. So that's how I saw the balance. And also, yeah, like Measure 97, for instance, was about getting more funding for education and healthcare. And, you know, that affects everyone, including Asian and Pacific Islanders, right, across the state. So a lot of these times you just have to look at the values, right, and know that if you do win, that's great. And if you don't, at least you want to fail forward or keep on pushing kind of the movement, because we got so many more people involved in our organizations and, you know, aware of politics because of what we did with Measure 97.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. I think I'm just like blown away by the amount of activism that happens, you know, that you guys are doing, and that has, you know, we talked about the intersectionality, like James mentioned, of different people being affected by it. And I'm curious, because I read on the website, it said that you guys are a community of contrasts, with some communities doing very well and some communities facing significant opportunity gaps, particularly in education, health, and economic prosperity. And so moving to Apano, I guess, what are some issues that the Asian and Pacific Islander communities face that other communities might not know about? And what are some things that you guys would like to highlight that our listeners can pay more attention to?
Yeah, so right now we just joined a coalition called Portland United Against Hate. And that's one of the biggest things right now, is as we're seeing in Oregon, with this legacy of white supremacy and white nationalism. So we are Portland United Against Hate is a community initiated partnership of community based organizations and neighborhood associations, really concerned and also with the city to build sort of like a rapid response system that combines reporting and tracking of hateful acts and providing support and protection to our communities. So that's one thing that's been overlooked in our communities, and especially at Apano. Last year, there was a white supremacist march in the neighborhood in the Jade District where we're located, and it impacted a lot of folks. So that's one of the biggest things we're starting to focus on now, is sort of addressing hate in our communities, especially within immigrant communities that we work with.
And, you know, I find it interesting, too, that you know, because this is going on, but I feel like in the media, when you're hearing about hate crimes that involve, you know, Asian Americans, you know, you're not hearing that as much. And it is happening. And so why is it, you know, like, do you know, like, how can we get the word out more about these things? And what are some of these other issues that are getting swept under the rug?
Why is there such a disparity?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's, if I had the golden answer to that, I you know, we'd be a lot further along. But I know that, you know, for one, just dealing with, you know, we say Asian Pacific Islanders, and that includes, right, like, at least, like, 15 or 16 countries with their different, or origin countries with their different languages and culture. So, you know, what we're trying to do is, it's really a political coalition, right, of Asians and Pacific Islanders, right? You know, even Pacific Islanders, most people wouldn't know what that necessarily represents. You know, we traditionally think of that as four major groups, right? Native Hawaiians, Micronesians, Polynesians, and Melanesians, right? And each of those have their own distinct backgrounds and contexts that they bring into, you know, living in Oregon. So one, it's just harder to bring about this coalition to, like, get the word out, right? Organizing takes a lot of teamwork and, you know, organizing the press and our elected officials. So there's that, like, natural just obstacle to get around. And then the second thing is, yeah, like, we haven't been getting our stories out in the same way about things like hate crimes that happen to our communities. And also, you know, things like the DACA program or Dreamers. And because, you know, Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders make up, you know, maybe upwards of a quarter of the undocumented population, but it's being, you know, drowned out by other narratives that other groups are pushing, you know, including, you know, more right-wing white nationalists, right, framing it as border crossings and things like that. But, you know, Asian Americans were the first undocumented people because they're the first people to be completely excluded from the country, right? But migration never stopped. The, you know, people moving for, you know, economic reasons or political reasons have never stopped in our history. But once they made it illegal or excluded whole classes of people like Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, right? Life continued and they had to figure out a way, but they just no longer had access to papers, right? So this legacy, this history needs to be told more. And you know, that's what we're trying to do, rallying our communities to see themselves in this like current fight, right? And to, you know, not let these things happen again, because we've seen it in our history in this country.
Yeah, I think too. So speaking of like rallying the communities and getting voter turnout, because I know that APANA was focusing on voter registration and 2018, 2020, a lot of these elections are coming up. I read, Robin, you wrote this amazing article in Medium where you talked about your experience with the New Americans Voter Project. And I just want to say this quote because I thought it was amazing. You said Chinese Americans would not be half Chinese, half American, or half anything but twice as much. And then you said, oh, you speak with an accent. That's wonderful. That must mean you speak more than one language. Being a, quote, new American means becoming part of a larger struggle and assuming an even bigger part of the American inheritance. First of all, I think that's amazing. And I'm just, if you could talk a little bit about your experience with the New Americans Voter Project and then talk about that experience and how we get the idea of the New Americans spread nationwide. Because we're sort of, you know, America used to be viewed as this melting pot, and it feels like we're veering away from that. And I think that groups like the New Americans Voter Project can hopefully rally the troops and we can increase voter registration and, you know, go on to a bigger, better future. But I just, yeah, I guess, sorry to wax poetic there for a second, but I'm just curious about your experience with all that.
No, totally. Thanks. Good research. You know, Medium is the place to wax poetic, is it not? The New Americans Voter Project is something that Jay and I both work on. And it's definitely like, yeah, it's something that we hope to see replicated across the country, right? Along with like voter laws, like we have here in Oregon, right? With automatic voter registration. But what we do a lot at APANO is not only this like on the ground organizing work, and you pointed out elections, but we also want to shift narratives, right? Through cultural work, through civic engagement at large, right? So, you know, we push back on ideas that just because you can't understand English doesn't mean that you don't understand like how oppression works, or like don't understand your communities, or you know, that you're somehow less intelligent, right? And fighting back against that kind of notion, or just because you haven't been involved in politics, you know, there could be really good reasons for that. And instead of shaming people into or blaming people for not being engaged, we should turn it around and say, what can we do to make people want to get engaged, right? Mm-hmm. Because for a lot of these communities, right, democracy is like a new concept, or getting political meant like persecution or death even. So we try to understand those contexts and bring that into our work. So the New American Voters Project, though, is a great way to engage people at this like moment that's supposed to be really powerful, right? People are so excited to get their, you know, certificate, their citizenship. Those ceremonies are really powerful. And I attended one, and I just wrote about my experience and how I thought about my parents when they went through that and all that meant. And if Jay wants to say more.
Yeah, you know, I'm currently, you know, trying to get volunteers for that right now and sort of taking the lead on that. And there's a lot of barriers at the USCIS office that, you know, I feel like they're trying to put more intimidation tactics and they're moving us upstairs and making it more inconvenient to register new voters. So it is a challenge, you know, to really convince people, especially new voters, I mean, new citizens, to really register. So that's one of the struggles we're experiencing right now. But I think we're going to continue fighting to make sure that, you know, this is accessible to everybody.
You know, it's funny you mentioned, it's not funny. I don't know what the right adjective is yet, but mentioning that ceremony, you know, that these immigrants or undocumented people or whomever we want to label that category have to go through in order to become a citizen. As someone who was born in the U.S., like, I didn't have to do that, you know, and I feel like I probably should have, because it's like, because I was born here, I allegedly just get grandfathered in and know things. It's very bizarre. It's something I've been thinking about a lot recently about, like, why didn't I have to do that? It probably would make everybody a little smarter.
It's that good old American privilege right there.
That's what it is. Anyways, yeah, I mean, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I mean, I think about that, you know, on the daily. I'm the only American born member of my family ever, right? On both sides, my mom and my dad. So being the only non-immigrant in a completely immigrant family, right? I thought about that like my entire life almost. So yeah. I definitely feel you there.
It's like, what if my mom was in Canada and she went into labor? Like, I would have had to go through that. Like, that's insane. Anyways.
Well, oftentimes the tests, I mean, you know, the tests that people have to take, most Americans can't answer.
Exactly. So. It's crazy. Well, I wanted to kind of touch on a couple things. You've already brought up a few misperceptions around the people you're working with. You know, I, for one, didn't know that 25% or a quarter of the undocumented population, you know, identifies as Asian Pacific American. And I also, you know, and there's also the misperception around the people that don't speak English are less intelligent. So what are some of the other misperceptions you're really fighting with on the daily, you know, and how are you reframing these conversations?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, APIs here in Oregon are one of the largest and fastest growing groups here. And from 2000 to 2010, our population grew 61% just behind the Latino population. And we make up 6% of Oregon's population. But compared to other groups, I think APIs have the lowest voter participation rate. And so that's one thing. You know, that's what drives APANO is to make sure to make this process as accessible and, you know, joyful as possible to, you know, get civically engaged. So I think that's one of the narratives we're trying to shift as well. Yeah, and I think, you know, a big one that we've hinted at is, you know, the model minority myth, right? That's, I think, something that comes up, you know, across generations in our work all the time. You know, this idea that Asian Americans, right, are specifically doing better, doing pretty well for a minority group, and it's, you know, therefore other groups should be able to achieve that success, right? So it's this positive framing of a stereotype that is still stereotype and is really damaging because it pits, you know, minorities against each other. It insinuates and assumes a lot of things that just aren't correct. And as I said earlier, right, when you think Asian, that could be so many things, right? So many different countries, like what generation are you? What's your different factors that come with it, right? Whether you're documented or, you know, quote unquote documented or undocumented, whatever. But if it gets all lumped together, then, you know, you can paint a picture that might suggest that, oh, you know, APIs don't care about politics, or they don't need help because they're doing so well, right? But that's certainly not the case across the board, and you know, it perpetuates this complacency, and we fight back against that as well, right? With students who, or with people who just don't see themselves in this activist fight. But you know, Asian Americans were some of the first groups to, you know, be classified legally as like alien and you know, without any possibility of becoming American based on, you know, eugenics and their skin color, you know? So there's a pervasive history that is coming, you know, repeating itself.
And that actually brings up a question that I've had for a while. And do you guys have an insight into the mindset of some of these people who, you know, they're coming, you know, either they're just attaining citizenship or they're just immigrating over here. And, you know, it's a hard transition for them. It has to be. And, you know, and you were saying there's a low voter turnout. And so do they automatically get here and just feel like they're underrepresented, or that their voice won't be heard, and so therefore they don't turn up to the polls? Like, what's that transition like for them, or what is that mindset?
Yeah, I think it's, for me, I think what I experience is a combination of things from language barriers to just feeling disenfranchised in their, you know, motherland or whatever. And so I think it's just a combination of issues that need to be addressed. And that's at Apano, we try to reduce those barriers to make civic engagement as just accessible as possible. So it takes a lot of effort and resources to do that.
So I think jumping into a specific issue, I know that I heard that you recently just won a campaign around affordable healthcare. And so I'm curious if you could tell us, you know, what that campaign was and what you accomplished, and also so we can congratulate you 100 times over, because that's super important.
Yeah, it's a big victory for Oregon. We were happy to play, you know, our role in this massive, you know, coalition to essentially protect Medicaid here in Oregon. So on January 23rd, this past Tuesday, as we're recording, by overwhelming majorities, you know, it's like almost 2/3 of the vote to protect Medicaid, the Oregon Health Plan, for over 400,000 Oregonians. And that was successfully passed. It was brought to the ballot by voter referendum. For any viewers outside of the West Coast, right, like citizens can sign petitions and bring policy issues to the public for a statewide vote, right? That's very, very common here in Oregon. The ballot, you know, ballot measures giveth and taketh away. But in this case, some what we feel are, you know, extremist right-wing groups brought this question of, do we give health care to the most needy in our state? They brought it up for a vote. So we were, you know, very concerned that if voters didn't understand what was being asked of them, they were being asked to vote in late January in Oregon during a cold winter, right? If it didn't pass, that all the gains from the Affordable Care Act would be lost. And a lot of the healthcare work that our organization, Apano, had been doing over the last decade would, you know, disappear overnight, because we would lose billions in a state budget for healthcare. So huge victory. The first election, for first statewide election post-Trump for Oregon, and we seem to have passed the test for now.
That is so exciting. What is, I mean, like, that is, I'm excited.
Especially in this age, like, it's no, like, any victory counts, and that's,
yeah,
and that's huge.
I mean, every victory is important right now. It's amazing. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, and it was a huge team effort. 175 groups, including Apano and, you know, community organizations, all the way up to the largest hospital providers in the state, made for an interesting team, but, you know, the voters responded, and yeah, we have preserved all that we've worked for, because Oregon's been one of the most aggressive states in healthcare expansion. For the first time this year, 100% of all kids, including undocumented children, have healthcare access.
And, that's
great. We're really excited about that.
So I'm curious, to piggyback off your comment of, you know, people are getting more involved, and, you know, the Oregon has been so instrumental in responding very quickly to this current administration. I was reading about Apano's strategic focus areas and, like, their plans for 2016 through 2020, and I was curious, you know, where you guys are right now, some things where you want to get to, and then in 2020, hypothetically speaking, and I know this is kind of a, you know, down the line question, but if we end up with a Democrat in the White House or a progressive in the White House in 2020, does the strategic plan of Apano change at all? Or is it the same under conservative or liberal leadership?
That's a great question. So I'll start with the first. So 2016, right, that plan definitely did not factor in our current administration. But at the same time, Apano here is, you know, we're locally based. We work on state and local politics, of course, you know, with things like immigration and foreign policy with a lot of countries that, you know, our communities originate from, right? Like, but national politics really matters. But I think one of the benefits of working with a group that's anchored, like, in a community, right, you know, that has cultural space, and, you know, we had a venue that hosted, you know, community events in one of the highest concentration of Asian Americans in the state in our census tract, this neighborhood called the quote unquote Jade District, right? So we were anchored in the community. People knew that we weren't just there for elections, that we would be there year round, that we are not just about, you know, winning healthcare, but we're also about providing, you know, you know, in language services, and we do cultural work, right? We help beautify and you know, the neighborhood. We work with the cities on the development plans in that neighborhood to prevent or to fight back against, you know, gentrification and displacement. So we're an organization that's anchored there, and that's you know, Jay and I happen just to work a lot on the civic engagement parts of our work and on these elections. But I think the strength of an organization like Apano is that we work with so many different groups and different programs, but, you know, people have a way to, like, attach to our organization and find their place. And then hopefully through that, they're able to learn about all these other things, including politics and policy and what's happening at our state capital. You know, not just a campaign that, you know, campaigns are worthwhile. And, you know, I urge everyone to get involved. You know, that was my first job, but campaigns fold after election date. But organizations like Apano, they stay and they continue to do the work. And even when we're campaigning, we're not just saying what needs to be said to get a yes vote, but we're trying to, like, educate and invest in these people who will be around for the next election and who we need to, you know, be involved in their community, run for office, you know, be better neighbors. So that strategic plan really reflects all of that. And in 2020, right, you know, in some ways it won't really affect what we're doing, but it kind of helps us expand relationships, right? If we're able to access the federal government, that could deliver more funds, right? Because right now people can, especially the Democratic Party, can say things like they support, you know, minority groups and marginalized communities, but, you know, the funding has to be there as well, and the services have to show up. So that's the hope, that could be changed in 2020.
Mm-hmm. Well, strategic plans are important and wonderful. I always call them, it's a plan you can deviate from, because you got to know, you got to at least have a map to know where you're starting.
Yeah, I mentioned the 2016 plan and definitely changed a little bit definitely with the current guy.
And yeah. It sounds like, I mean, you're tackling so many different things, and you have, and your vision is incredible. And clearly the time you're putting in on the ground is working. You know, we can point back to this recent success with healthcare, but I'm sure there's been many before that. So how do you two as individuals balance, you know, all of this really challenging work that's emotional and it's mentally stimulating and sometimes physical if you're at a rally? You know, how do you balance this activism work with, like, getting enough sleep at night and remembering to eat your vegetables? How do you do that?
Yeah, you brought up food. We always have food in our office.
Smart.
You know, that's
smart.
A strong cultural component to our work.
I support that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question for me. You know, I'm fairly new to organizing, and I just got out of university, so I get burnt out real quickly. So that's a real big issue I think our office, since I started working at Apano, is addressing. You know, self-care is super important to avoid burnout. And as Audre Lorde said, that, you know, caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it's self-preservation, and that's an act of political warfare. So just, you know, taking care of ourselves is really important, because we as marginalized communities know that this is a marathon we're doing. You know, it's not a short-term sprint, and, you know, this fight will take probably generations. So it's really important to just, like, start taking care of ourselves. And it's just a learning process for me, you know, and it's going to take time. But really just having, you know, a community that holds us accountable. I have coworkers that come to me and say, you know, like, Jay, you need to slow down, take a deep breath, let's go for a walk or something. You know, little things like that make a big difference. And, you know, it's a learning process. So, yeah.
I love what you just said. Self-care is not self-indulgent, it's self-preservation, and you're dead on. And so I'm curious about, you know, for our listeners, they're hearing all this amazing work you're doing. You know, they might have listened to our section on the news, and so they're super stimulated right now. And so what would you suggest as a first step for someone getting involved in activism? How can they engage in things they believe in beyond the typical sign another petition or like something on Facebook? You know, what can they do?
Yeah, I think you start with, you know, what is it that you get enjoyment out of, right? The last thing we need is people doing something they think is the right thing, but hating it while they do it, right? So you want to find things that give you joy, and you want to do it in community. right? Because here, like when I talked about local groups, right? So we, our doors are always there. We're rooted in the community. Actually, we are, we just started groundbreaking and construction on this new community space that's going to open up in 2019. You know, it's a 4-story tall affordable housing unit. And on the first floor, it's going to be our new offices and a huge community space for like performances and workshops and just this space that doesn't exist currently in that neighborhood because of underdevelopment. You know, we organized money in our communities to make that down payment, to secure that space in the heart of the district to preserve that for decades as a community space. So finding community is really important. And you know, joining with Aponte, like we've talked a lot about elections, but there's ways like through organizations like ours, like you can directly work with people that you might not get the chance to see usually, right? So we're starting up teaching ESL to immigrants and non-English speaking folks, right? We're doing cultural work. We are, you know, commissioning like mural projects in the neighborhood and all this good stuff. So there's finding those organizations that do things that you enjoy, not just like win elections, because for most people, they don't know like what that looks like. They might know, you know, oh, I go phone bank, I go text, but the more invested you can get in an organization, I think the more like fun it gets, right? The more you can do the strategic plan and think about where you'll be in 5 years, that gives people a lot of energy.
Absolutely. I mean, and I'm sitting here feeling like we've just brushed the surface of what you're doing and how people can be inspired by and learn more about activism through Aponte. But I mean, we're at our time, which is insane because I have so many more questions.
We'll get you back on. We got to get you back on in the future.
We're going to have to get you back on. But I'm so thankful that you both were able to pause in the activism to come chat with us, which you might say is another form of activism. I'm just going to say it. So thank you so much for your time.
That's the one Audre Lorde quote that doesn't get mentioned. It's like talking on podcasts is another form of activism.
That's right. That's
yeah.
right.
People don't quote that as much.
Yeah. And I will, my last note I want to say is,
yes.
For folks out there listening, right, you want to ask others to get involved with you, and you have to really ask them in a concrete way, because one of the best things that, you know, a former organizer taught me was, if you don't make that ask, you've already made the decision for them. But
yes.
if you make that ask, you give them that opportunity. And some people are just waiting to be asked or haven't thought about it in a certain way. But if you make that concrete, you don't know where they'll get started, right? Jay and I don't think we grew up thinking we'd be organizers, but someone, you know, asked us to do this work. And now, you know, we're pretty happy to be doing it.
Yep. Wow. I think that's such an important point, and it goes for fundraising too. They say the number one reason why donors don't give is they don't get asked. So
exactly, yeah.
Be specific with your ask. I love it. So everyone listening, thank you so much to Jay Singh and Robin Yee, field organizers of the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, otherwise known as Aponte. You can learn more about their organization at aponte.org, or they're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Aponte News.
And we are on social media at We Rebel Podcast.
That's right, James.
On Facebook and on Twitter and Instagram. You can send us emails to WeRebelPodcast@gmail.com.
We love
do
our
respond.
Emails. We always
wow.
respond.
Yes. I always do this ending bit. It's interesting hearing it from
we're
someone
just trying
else.
To phase you out. It's
yeah,
fine.
That's fine. Also, hit up that donate button. On a, go to aponte.org. That's APANO.org. Donate. Help. Get involved. Everything. Awesome. Fantastic.
All right. Thanks, Jay and
Thank
Robin.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
What's a Creative Podcast Network?
This is Marcy Jarrow.
This is Jessica Jardin.
We're the co-hosts of Kardashianed, a podcast about all things Kardashian.
Each week, we watch every episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians and every dang spinoff imaginable, recapping all the drama for you.
We talk about everything to do with Kardashians, all the latest news, pop culture, feminism, who's pregnant, answer all of them at some point, maybe even Rob, and even sports if one of them's dating an athlete.
Or a rapper, and we'll probably get their names wrong. So subscribe to Kardashianed on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us. Thank you.
Goodbye.